Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and I'm finally back after a grueling month of travel. Can't really complain though, because that means I'm working, and it's always good to be working. I'm very, very grateful for some of the opportunities that I've had recently. I'm also grateful, or should I say thankful, we just passed the Thanksgiving holiday. I'm also thankful for all of you, the supporters of the show, the listeners of the show. So I want to give a few shout outs right here at the top. The first is to Nicholas Recker. Next, I want to thank Mark Bahaj. And also, I want to thank Michael Quinn. Thank you guys for setting up recurring contributions to the show. They're incredibly helpful. I couldn't do it without you. I also want to thank Masra Klamengau from Seattle, Washington, for your generous contribution. I want to thank Cody Lairmouth from Victoria, British Columbia, for your contribution. I also want to thank Jedediah Williams from Thornton, Colorado. Thank you so much, Jedediah. I want to thank Kevin Deal from Concord, North Carolina. Thank you, Kevin. I also want to thank, as always, Rick Richardson from Elma, Washington. Rick, thank you so much for your continued support. And last but not least, I want to thank Brad Chang, who made an incredibly generous contribution, probably the biggest one that Talk Nerdy has seen so far. Brad, thank you so much. Again, all of you, I really could not do this without the kindness and the support of listeners like you. As you guys know, Talk Nerdy and most podcasts that are out there are free to download on iTunes and Stitcher. You probably know that because you're listening right now. And the way that we keep the podcast, the way that I should say I, there's no we. Whenever I say we, I'm literally talking about me and my dog in terms of the work that we, quote unquote, do on the podcast, because it's really just me. But the way that I keep this 100% free to download is through generous contributions from folks like you, through merchandise purchases at the Talk Nerdy store, which you can reach at carasantamaria.com/store. I've also got some new pieces up, just so you know, some cool new autograph pieces. So you should check those out. And lastly, I keep the podcast free to download through advertisements. Now, you may have noticed that I don't have an ad this week for you. And I'm sure most of you are like, yes, because that means more content and less listening to sponsorships. But I think that most of you also totally understand that to have advertiser support is absolutely invaluable. It allows me to dedicate a lot more time to the podcast than I would have been able to otherwise as a freelancer. You know, I got to like partition up my time, and because a podcast is not a moneymaker, but it's a real passion project, it's something I love, the advertisements help me kind of keep it going and not go into the hole doing it. That being said, I just wanted to let everybody know that I do have some opening spots some spots open in December for ad space. So if you or someone you know is a small business owner, I especially love working with you. I mean, I work with big clients too, but small businesses, kind of indie businesses, I think that's a really fun thing to do because that's what I've got going on with Talk Nerdy. We can help each other out. So if you are interested, just shoot an email to me at shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. Again, that's shoptalknerdy@gmail.com. That is also where you'll hit me up, by the way, if you are an international listener and you're interested in making a purchase from the Talk Nerdy store. You may have tried to and noticed that my checkout software only allows like 2 or 3 international countries outside of the US, but I can ship to pretty much anywhere in the world. You just have to send me a separate email and I can invoice you directly. All right, guys, business is done. I want to get into the good stuff. I'm really excited about my guest this week. We chatted at the Skepticon conference over in Springfield, Missouri, just about a week ago. You may know him as the Friendly Atheist. He is actually the editor at friendlyatheist.com. He's also a YouTuber at The Atheist Voice. He has 2 books, one called I Sold My Soul on eBay, and the other, The Young Atheist Survival Guide. If you don't know him, you're soon to find out what an amazing guy he is. Please welcome Hemant Mehta. Hyman, thank you so much for joining me in this lovely hotel room in Springfield, Missouri. This is the strangest hotel I've ever stayed in for a conference, I think.
It looks like you're in some like resort and then you're off into a maze of
It's so strange. Like I kind of think there's this atrium in the middle with a beautiful pool and it's kind of lovely, but then everything else is like from 1982. It's very strange. But
I kind of want to, you can take your vacation in the atrium as you walk through. Yeah.
But you know what? I've been inside now for 2 days straight. I got here for Skepticon, for the conference that we're attending. I got here on, I guess, Friday night.
Yeah.
And now it's Saturday night. So, okay, that's one day.
Yeah.
And then I leave tomorrow. You just came in.
I just got in, yeah.
But it's so cold in Missouri. I don't want to leave the hotel.
This is actually warmer for me coming here from Chicago.
Oh,
so I was outside and I'm like, oh, this is great weather.
It's balmy,
this is awesome.
Oh,
I'm
going to
take off my jacket. I don't need it. It was great.
That's so funny. Coming from LA, this sucks. And I remember looking at the weather about a week ago and seeing at the time that the low here was 10 degrees.
Yeah, that
and
sounds
I was like,
about right.
I don't think it's that bad now.
Yeah, it was all right when I got in right now. So.
That's good. And so you're giving your talk tomorrow at the conference. What is your talk going to be about?
The talk's going to be about how, you know, we as skeptics pride ourselves on calling out bullshit wherever we see it, right? But we tend to fall for a lot of the same type of thing ourselves. And, you know, when it suits our purposes, we're like everybody else. We're like, oh, no, of course I believe this.
Yep.
And you know what? It's really bad. There's one thing when no one calls you out on that. It's like, well, we should tell the truth to ourselves. But it's another thing when you do get called out on it. And that's embarrassing.
Oh, and so what do you do?
It's like, oh, yeah, we shouldn't have put that out there. And, you know, if you're the people who try to pride yourselves on being the rational, truthful, honest ones, and someone else is like, well, you just lied about this or you're inaccurate about this.
Sure.
That you figure that should be something we ought to, at least we can look at that and say, yes, we screwed up. We will fix it.
Yeah, we more than anybody.
We
should be able to,
right? So that's the gist of the talk. What do we screw up and how do we fix that?
How do we deal with it? Yeah. That's so funny because we all have a thing.
Yeah.
You know, I had a good friend, have a good friend that I remember talking to about skepticism and atheism and being really excited when I found out that this person was an atheist and had very similar kind of ideas that I had. And I wrote a piece, this was back when I was at the Huffington Post, and I wrote a piece about vaccines and about like me, I'm vaccinated, so good. You got to get your flu vaccine. And I remember talking to this person, and he was like, oh, I don't get a flu vaccine. And I was like, why? And he was like, oh, I'm afraid I'll get sick, or I'll get the flu.
Right, right.
And I was like, well, flu vaccines don't give you the flu. Like,
We have our blind spots.
Totally.
And it's annoying. And again, I'm not saying I'm above it.
No, we all have them.
But we're so afraid to like admit that, and we're bad at it. And we at least I don't feel like at other places they would be like, well, let's point out our mistakes and fix them. They're hesitant to do that. We should not be.
Yeah.
So that's the hope.
I love it. That's exciting.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
It's fun pointing out all the ways we get it wrong.
Completely. Because we do. We really do.
We totally do.
So what actually got you involved in not just the movement, but like in being an outspoken atheist to begin with? I mean, people call you the friendly atheist.
Yeah,
you blog as the friendly atheist.
I probably get more mail and I was like, you're not very friendly because you criticized something or... It was like, oh, you spoke about religion, but you were like gloves were off, and you know you were ready for fight or something. Well, I'm not gonna not criticize religion.
Completely.
That's not
it's
unfriendly.
Friendly. It's friendly to criticize. I think.
I think more than anything else, I hope that even if you read the site or you see the videos or something, it's like I could talk to that guy. I'm not afraid of talking to that guy, even if I disagree with him.
Yeah.
Because I know he's not gonna like chew me out just for thinking this. It doesn't mean I agree with them or I approve of all their ideas, but it's like, yeah, I hope people see it and they're like, I could talk to that guy. And
totally.
I don't think that's the case with a lot of atheists out there.
I agree. I think there's a big difference between being a dick and being, you know, you can be respectful and have an opinion that's different from somebody else's or a worldview that's different and be firm, you know, and critique them, but still be respectful.
And that's a very hard thing to find. And so that's where I'm hoping that's what the name means to some people. But I got involved when in college, you know, I became an atheist when I was probably a freshman in high school.
Okay.
Didn't tell too many people. Got to college and finally I'm like, I want to meet other atheists. I really don't know that many.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out I wanted to start a group. I met someone who also wanted to start a group, so we started a group. And I got to meet some people through there. Just like, oh, wow, there are other atheists out there. They've been through the same things. And the girl I started it with had been a counselor at Camp Quest, the summer camp for, like, kids of atheist parents and stuff.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I'm like, I didn't know that was a thing, but cool, interesting. So she's like, oh, and by the way, there's a group called the Secular Student Alliance. That's kind of the Campus Crusade for Christ, but for atheists in a mm-hmm. sense. We should be affiliated with them. We should work with them. They do awesome things. So I ended up, long story short, I became a board member on that organization, and I started working with a lot of the other organizations that work to do church-state separation or push humanism or whatever. And that was fascinating. It's behind-the-scenes work, and it's important work, but it was really cool. I got to meet a lot of really interesting people through all that.
But it's not very, like you said, it's not very visible.
No, it's not very visible. And then I think, you know, I had planned to go to medical school, and I went for a year. And then I'm like, I don't think I want to be doing this.
It's totally what I did with grad school. I did my master's, but like for my PhD, 1 year. And I was I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out.
And it was the weirdest decision where I'm like, this is the only thing I've been working toward for a long time. And I don't want to do this for 10 more years and then figure out that this is not what I want to do.
Exactly.
So I requested a year off. They let me have a year off because my grades were okay. They said, let us know a year from now if you want to do your M2 year.
Mm-hmm.
And in that year off, I got certified to be a teacher. I took all the classes, almost all the classes I needed to do that. And I think at some point along the line, I'm like, I think I could do this and not be homeless. Because that was the fear,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that was, so I'm like, okay, I'm not going back to med school. I will do my student teaching and I will go into teaching and all that. But realize all of these classes I was taking to get certified, this was like an adult program, meaning mm-hmm. all the classes were at night because all the people were working during the day and trying to do career changes at night.
Sure.
So I was, all my classes were in the evening. I had this daytime relatively free because I was not going to school anymore. I was working part-time and stuff, but it wasn't every day. So I had a lot of free time. And I realized at some point here, yeah, I'm very curious about this stuff. I'm still doing volunteering with all these atheist groups. I've never been to church.
Huh.
I grew up Jain. It's an Indian religion, J-A-I-N. But so I've been to my temple.
So what? How is that? I mean, this is a silly question. How is it different than Hindu? Or is it a type?
So Jainism is... It is not the same philosophy. There is some overlap.
All of my Indian friends were Hindu.
Yeah.
All of them.
More than anything else, Jains believe in, it's a philosophy. They believe in nonviolence. It's not so much the gods.
Sure.
It's more of a, don't be violent, meaning be vegetarian. Don't even think bad thoughts, because that's mental violence in a sense. And that's kind of the overarching philosophy.
That's
there is heaven and hell. There is karma and reincarnation, and that's where I drew the line. But anyway,
there's some crossover in
the ideas.
I definitely have heard, like, I have a very good friend who's Indian who's just finishing medical school actually right now.
Join the club.
Yeah. And she says that when she goes back home, she likes how, and by home, I mean, she's lived here most of her life, but when she goes back to visit, she likes how a lot of the kind of iconography in the country is philosophers.
Yeah.
That the statues are
you
of thinkers.
You honor the thinkers.
Yes,
it's great.
Which is really beautiful. So, and she is one of these people she's Hindu and she has an altar in her closet and but it's more, even for her, I think more of a philosophy.
Yeah. And maybe it's more of a cultural thing in a lot of places too. And so this is what I grew up in, but all the people I was working with in these organizations were almost all ex-Christians.
Yes.
They all left church. And if you ask them, you know, what was your experience like in church? It was never good.
No.
But it seems like they had this baggage and stuff. And it's like, okay, it sounds like church is bad. But I've never experienced this for myself. Like, if you ask me what church is like, I'm thinking Reverend Lovejoy from The Simpsons. It's boring. It's monotone. Or I'm hearing these horror stories from what some of these people experienced at evangelical churches and stuff.
Which, for some people, it is like that.
It absolutely is.
And also, I think there's something about being... You know, as somebody who was raised Mormon, coming up through this culture, we're like a snippet of church. Going to church for a little while, probably you'd be like, wow, the Mormon church is great.
Right.
It's more about all of the stuff that comes along with being a churchgoer, all of the baggage.
And that's what I'm hearing about. And it's like, well, I mean, I can take your word for it, but I want to experience it. But here's the thing. I don't want to just walk. I don't even know what to do. Do I just walk into a church and experience it? I want to ask people questions. I feel like I can't just like raise my hand during the sermon and be like, let me ask you a question.
Well, then there's almost this immediate kind of fear of the outsider, right. of the person who's coming in to like, what are you trying to make us look bad? Are you trying
try being the brown guy who walks into an evangelical church on a Sunday morning, right?
I'm sure.
Like, they'll notice me. I can't even like blend in.
And at this point, are you living on the East Coast?
No, I'm living in Chicago downtown because I'm working downtown and I was living there to go to school. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was living with the girl I was dating too. So like I was kind of set there, but it's in the middle of Chicago. There's a lot of churches out there. Mm-hmm. I don't really know the difference between them, but I'm like, I want to go. I have time. Like I want to go. So what ended up happening is I ended up for some reason putting this thing on eBay mm-hmm. at the time where I'm like, if you want me to go to church, I will go. Yeah. You can bid on where I go. I will donate the money. It's not about this being money making for me, but maybe that's a way to get publicity.
Yeah.
And you could bid on where I go. And what ended up happening is this Christian pastor won the auction for a little over $500.
Wow, which meant, so there was like good bidding there.
Yeah, you had atheists bidding that I don't go to church, and you had Christians bidding I go to their church, and they just kept setting each other off.
That's so funny.
It was hilarious and kind of scary because I didn't think it was going to go past like $10.
Sure.
And this guy,
at the time, I mean, how much kind of... following, how much publicity did you have? Were you blogging already?
No,
were you...
I wasn't doing anything. So no one knew who the hell I was, which is fine. But the story of, this atheist is offering to go to church got publicity. And when he won the auction, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal is like, I want to come with you when you go to your first church visit. Because I actually owed this guy a year's worth of Sundays of church.
A whole year?
A year.
Well, and, I guess that's what $500 will buy.
10 bucks a week. That was a dumb idea in retrospect. Here's the good part. The guy was like, don't go for 50 weeks because that would turn me off to church. And he's a pastor.
Oh, how
he's
funny.
He's like, go to 10. Let me pick them out for you because I know the difference between all these churches.
Huh.
Go to 10, but in return, you write about your experiences on my ministry's website.
What an open-minded pastor.
The guy was great.
Yeah.
And he loved this because you know what? His thing was he hates how evangelicals bait and switch you. There's, you know, This American Life, that great podcast?
Of course.
They did an episode called Bait and Switch where mm-hmm. they interviewed this guy because he is such a, not a proponent of Christians who do that. They're like, let's be friends, but really they just want to convert you.
Yes.
So he's all about, he used to do this thing where he's like, there's a church, they hold seeker services for people who don't belong there. He'll stand outside and he's like, hey, random stranger walking by. What are you doing for the next hour? Nothing. I will give you $25 if you go to that church service and all you I won't get your name. I won't get your email. I'm not going to bother you. In return, all you got to do, fill out this one-page survey for me.
Huh.
And the survey was like, were the seats comfortable? Did you like the sermon? Did you like the music? All this stuff.
Yeah. Did you feel welcome?
Yeah. And he would take all these surveys and go up to the pastor and he would be like, you know, you said you wanted to reach out to people who don't go to church. Well, I talked to them and here's what they said about your service.
How funny.
So Ira Glass interviewed him about all this. But so this guy, he's heard about my auction. He's like, jackpot, this is my thing. So he made that deal. Go to 10 churches, write about it on my ministry's website. And that's what I did. And what was really cool is, yes, there was some publicity when the reporter wrote about that article, and it's a big newspaper and everything. So there was that. But you don't want to be the guy who sold. It got like he sold his soul, quote unquote, on eBay. I'm like, that's not the reputation you want to have.
Also, I don't believe in the soul.
So yeah, well, yeah. And so, but what really happened is I wrote these things for his website, and it was run as a blog. And I'm like, I'd never done that before. You write something and get this immediate feedback. But there were Christians commenting, and they were like, I agree with you. I hate this aspect of my church, mm-hmm. or you're wrong about this, but let me tell you why, like, you misunderstood what was going on.
Sure.
And you had atheists very, very kindly, politely saying, I agree with you. This is why I left the church. It was the coolest discussion, and you don't see that anymore online, you know?
That's so great, too, because I think you also see a lot of atheists, which is why conventions like this are so important.
Yeah.
Atheists who say, you know, I left the church, but I really miss...
Yeah.
Some of the things the church offered
me. And the churches I was going to, they were doing so many things right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's a lot of problems I saw, and I wasn't shy about saying that. But it's like, oh my God, this is so cool. No wonder all these people go here all the time. Like, I would too if I could bring myself to believe this stuff. Well, after I was done writing for his website, I'm like, well, this was kind of, I want to keep this going where I can write and get this feedback. And that's when I started my own website. And so, I mean, I had a little residue from the publicity of that original stunt, but it turned out when I kept writing about atheism, and I've been doing that. And I stuck with it for a long time. That's where I guess this friendly atheist stuff kind of came from. I mean, that was the name of the site, but like that's where it kind of grew. And I mean, thankfully, when I meet people now, they don't bring up, oh, you sold your soul, which is very nice.
But you did actually write a book about it.
I did write a so that was one
your
of the
first book.
That was the first book. And that was a cool opportunity because a Christian publisher that had worked with this pastor, this bait and switch pastor, they were watching this. It was great publicity for his book that he had written for them a long time ago.
Of course.
And they were watching this carefully and they're like, you know, this is very weird that an atheist can criticize Christian churches. And Christians are loving it.
Yeah. And because you're doing it in a very respectful and kind of...
And not purposely. Like, I genuinely was like, yeah, this stuff is really good and this stuff is not. And that's... I've never been here, so this is what I'm seeing.
And so it really wasn't about the dogma, the rhetoric. It was about, like...
The presentation.
The presentation style. Like, that guy was really boring.
And this is the same... A publishing company that recently put out a book by Matthew Vines, who is the Christian who's like, I read the Bible, I am a Christian, and you know what? The Bible verses we use to condemn homosexuality, we are misinterpreting the way they are. The Bible is fine with gay marriage. He wrote a book about why the Bible is fine with gay marriage.
Interesting.
And you can argue with that, his argument there, but that book has become, it's one of the biggest things I've seen online in the Christian world over the past year, because people are talking about it. It's the same publisher, so they love these type of challenging the church
I
sort of books.
I think that's great, because I think that there is room in the conversation for intellectual theological discourse.
Yeah, and new voices that you're not used to hearing. And you know what? The editor was, they're all super Christian at this publishing company, and I would write these drafts of chapters and I'd send them to my editor, and he'd be like, well, you wrote this, but don't atheists actually believe this? And I'm like, you are right about that. Like, good catch. I was
That's
wrong.
Hilarious.
So the editor was fantastic because he wanted to make sure it was my voice that got through.
Completely.
And that I wasn't lying about, not lying, that I wasn't misstating anything. So, I mean, it was just a fantastic experience. I got very lucky, by the way, because I have friends who have worked with publishers and it's not a good experience, but this was just professional and
especially
just
not a Christian publisher.
Especially,
I mean, that could
not.
Be very scary as an atheist. Did you did you catch any flack though from the atheist community?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Well, not so much for working with a Christian publisher, but for just
for being
saying,
something of an apologist or
in
even
a
more,
sense
for being somebody who's basically giving Christians
the tools
to be a better church.
To be better able to reach out to atheists to bring them into the Christian fold.
To fellowship better.
Yeah. And no doubt that was part of the book, which is to say, you want to reach out to me, let me tell you how it looks so that you can do a better job of this. But I mean, anything you do will get criticized. But for the most part, I think people understood what the point of this was. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I wanted to see new Christian converts. It's that I'm annoyed by some of the ways they were trying to reach out to atheists, some of the things the church leaders said about atheists when they didn't know there was one sitting in the pews.
Completely.
You know, guys, if we want to reach out to atheists, we have to understand they have no morals. So we have to, like, it's you hear things like that, and it's like, you're just wrong. Like, let me try to
and
fix
like,
that.
How insulting is
how
that?
Insulting is that? And so it's like, I'm more annoyed by that, and I want to help you fix that because you're wrong. It's not that I think you're going to be effective, because even if you were honest about it, I don't think you're going to get us to start believing this stuff.
No, I mean, most atheists are atheists not because church is not fun.
Right.
They're atheists because they have intellectual qualms with the idea of believing God.
And I didn't
God.
Think they were going to overcome that. So I wasn't worried that this was suddenly going to become a tool to bring, to decrease the number of atheists. So those criticisms just, they faded away quickly. So I got lucky, though, that I think if it happened now, I'd probably get way more flack for it.
Yeah.
But at the time, they didn't know me. And
well, what
this
a great
a cool
kind
experience.
Of entree into this world, too, that you got to have this experience somewhat under the radar.
Yeah.
Before you got a lot of the kind of attention that you have
now. Yeah,
now
if I do anything, it's like, this is either great or you're the worst person in the world. Which
Tell
is,
me about
comes with the
yeah, comes,
comes
with
the
territory,
right?
For sure.
But at the time, they were. If I got criticism, it was for the most part constructive. So that was, and that's kind of. I started with the website. Then I went from talking more about my personal thoughts about these things to reporting more on news stories and including my thoughts on it. So there's the progression from the website. But that's kind of how I got involved in all this and started doing it. And, you know, I was all this time, I was still working with those groups, you know, behind the scenes, which is great. And I'm still doing that today. So
and so
great.
Even along the lines, when you kind of, you left academia,
yeah.
you had this whole big experience. You're still working with these kind
of secular
groups.
I was student teaching when the book was coming out.
So they didn't have any problems with you doing this while you were a teacher?
They were very good about it because, one, I didn't talk about it in the classroom.
Okay.
It was if we discussed it, it was in the office or something with colleagues.
And was this kind of pre-Twitter?
It was pre-Twitter.
Pre-Facebook?
It was early Facebook.
Okay. So there probably wasn't a lot of chance for even your kids to get wind of it.
Unless
via
they
media.
Looked my name up, they wouldn't have found it.
Which now, like, I think all students do.
Now
but
they,
back
yeah.
then,
right.
it was different.
Exactly. So a couple of kids brought it up. Like, I would be like, hey, kid, where's your homework? Like, because I'm checking in. Did you do your homework lesson? Oh, I didn't do it because I was too busy selling my soul.
Like,
yeah, you're hilarious. But they were great. I mean,
and so you went to a pretty secular. I mean, you were teaching at
a big public school.
Yeah,
they were. I mean, no one was upset about it. And the book had not come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one of those. It was in the news, so they kind of
so
saw
the
that
the Wall
the
Street,
articles
yeah.
were out there yeah. and stuff. But they were pretty good about it. And I was done student teaching, so my biggest concern was I was trying to apply for actual teaching jobs, and the book was out
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And it's like my entire leadership experience, scholarships I've earned, all the good stuff you want to include on a resume, all had to do with atheism at this point.
How funny. And you're like, do I put that in the resume?
That was the question.
Do
and
I leave it
I didn't.
Out?
I left it all up. My resume was more or less a blank slate,
oh,
with the
funny.
One exception where I'm like, I've written a book, because I thought I could get some leverage out of that, but I didn't say anything.
I don't want to tell you
right.
what it's called or
right.
what it's about. And you had started medical school.
Right.
That's
and so
impressive.
I'm like, well, so I'm like, my grades are good.
Yeah.
Like, can you work with that?
Oh,
and I got
funny.
Lucky that they were trying to hire, and I got in early because I'm like, I know I'm looking for a job. I finished student teaching. So they were looking to hire. And a great school was like, well, come chat with us for an interview.
Because even in a progressive place like Chicago, I mean, I can't imagine if you had been in Mississippi
yeah.
or Louisiana.
And I was in a conservative suburb of Chicago, but it's not Mississippi. It's
no,
a big difference.
It's totally different.
I had my first interview. They focused on math and stuff, and it was fine. They called me in for a second interview with the principal, who you could tell because he wore like a cross necklace. Like,
yeah.
This guy was pretty religious. But at some point, he's like, so what's this book about? And I was very honest in the sense where I'm like, well, I think it helped the fact that I'm brown, seriously. Because
yeah.
because I said, well, I didn't grow up religious in a Christian environment, and I explored a lot of Christian churches and wrote about my experiences, which is totally true.
Totally. You didn't
and
talk
not
about,
offensive.
You didn't have to talk about the outcome of
right.
that exploration.
And his response was like, that sounds really neat. I'm
How
like,
funny.
it was a very educational experience.
Yeah.
It was all like,
all
by the,
true.
It's all true.
It's a sliver of
yeah.
what happened, but it's definitely
and,
true.
And they hired me after that conversation. And that was the school I worked at for the next 7 years. And it's a great school. I'm still coaching there, a team that I coach for. But yeah, it was an awesome experience. But thankfully, none of the activism that I did
mm-hmm.
impacted.
Like bled over.
Yeah. The parents only seemed to care about, did you teach my kid math?
Well, and it probably also helps that you were a math teacher. You weren't
yeah,
a sociology teacher.
I wasn't teaching evolution.
Exactly. Which,
right.
I mean, you could have easily done if you had been going to medical school. What was your undergrad in?
My math and biology.
Okay. So you did a double. But you chose to go math as a teacher.
Yeah. I chose to do, when you're applying to med school, they're like, well, then don't do biology because you're going to do it for the rest of your life. So I was doing math, and then I realized with all the pre-med classes I was going to take, they're like, yeah, just take a couple more and get your bio degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I went ahead and did that. So.
And what made you say, okay, I really want to teach math in school?
It was a cool, I always just found it awesome
yeah.
and fascinating. And I think like my freshman year of high school, like when I was taking a math class, it just clicked and it made sense. And so for the next few years anyway, and I got lucky that my math teachers were always awesome. And so for like the next 3 years, like I lucked out. I had good friends in those classes and we all took the same class together basically. So I had them all in my class for like 4 years. And the teachers were always great. And so I'm like, I like this. I enjoy this. Even when it gets hard and it's
mm-hmm.
annoying.
Then it's like solving problems.
Yeah. There's still some logic to it and I enjoy it and stuff. And I enjoy it. This should have been a sign, but I'm like, I enjoy this way more than I like my biology classes. But what am I going to do with math? I have a path with
That's
science.
So yeah. I think a lot of people, you know, I talk on this podcast a lot about STEM because
yeah.
I talk about women in STEM
yeah.
and role modeling and things. And when we talk about STEM, what I find is that arbitrary number, 95%
yeah.
of the time, we're talking about STE.
Right. No one's talking about math.
We never talk about math. We hardly ever talk about engineering, and we never talk about math.
Because it's an ingredient in all those other things, but it's never necessarily like the end of the conversation. Because
yes.
What are you going to do with math? It's a part of something else.
It's a building block for us to do science or build technologies.
Right.
And also, it gets not a bad rap in the news, but it gets no rap in the news.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
when's the last time you read a news story about math?
Only recently, because of this whole Common Core thing that people have a misinterpretation of what it is and what it's calling for. So the controversy I see with math, which is hilarious because it's not controversial, is the same thing I think a lot of our parents would have seen maybe 20 years ago or something, which is they're like, oh, my son or daughter came home with this assignment and they're supposed to add or multiply this way, but it's not the way I learned it, therefore it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I think the benefit is I can look at that and be like, oh, I see what they're doing here. If you learn it the new way, it's actually going to help your kids learn harder stuff down the road. It's funny. I've been writing about atheism for 8-some years now.
Mm-hmm.
The most popular thing I have ever written is an explanation of why that way you're learning to multiply is not a bad way.
Oh, how funny.
It has nothing to do with religion, but that thing gets passed around on Facebook like crazy, where people are like, this person explains what's right about Common Core.
Because so many people are talking about what's wrong.
Right.
And I
obviously, it's a brainwashing tool from
yes.
the Obama administration. It's like, no, I'm looking at this. It's like, because here's an example of what I'm talking about. If I asked you to do 500 minus 25 or something, there is a way we all learn where you write it down on paper and you look at the ones digits and
yes.
you carry the 10 and you do all this stuff. And it works. And it always works if you do it right. But the thing is, those skills don't teach you anything. Or remember in algebra class, if you ever learned FOIL?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when you don't just have a problem that's conducive to foiling? What happens when there's like three terms in the parentheses? So my students would have trouble with that. And it's like, well, FOIL is stupid because you're learning a mnemonic for learning a math skill. Yeah, you'll get it right when you're doing that.
But you can't then apply those skills to something slightly more complicated.
It doesn't scale.
Yeah.
And so what the new version of math is if you learn it this way, it'll scale better down the road.
And I don't really know anything about the new Common Core. I do know,
yeah.
I will admit
Neither
to
do
you,
a lot of parents.
I'm sure. And I'm not a parent,
right,
so
right.
at least I have an excuse. I do know that, for example,
yeah.
I am somebody who struggled with math in
yeah.
school, as I'm sure you hear all the time.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I wasn't good at math. Math was hard, whatever. I excelled in my statistics courses
yeah.
because I loved the idea of manipulating data in such a way that I could visualize it better.
Yeah.
Instead of, for example, let's say even complicated algebra was something that was a bit... intangible to
Too
me.
Too abstract.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, algebra, it's like they had me until imaginary numbers. And then I was like, what?
Right.
I don't, why? Why? And so that was always complicated for me. But
yeah.
even early on,
yeah.
I was this kid who kind of refused to follow the rules. And I know that for example, I still to this day don't know my basic multiplication tables.
Uh-huh.
And the reason for that is that I realized early on that 2 times 8 is the same thing as 2 times 4 plus 2 times 4. So
right.
why should I learn beyond 4 or beyond 5?
Right,
because
you can reduce
it
down to something smaller. Right.
And so I definitely learned math in a weird way that was about trying to get into the quantification and understand why
you
we
learn
do it
something
that way.
Called number sense, and you know how to manipulate those numbers. So many kids, and almost all the ones who tell me they hate math,
mm-hmm.
they never picked that up.
Interesting.
They know how to do the basic, they know the algorithms.
The rote stuff.
The rote
yeah.
stuff.
They have a table in their head.
Right. And if it's not in their head, like all those people who are like, oh, well, I learned this as a kid, but I can't help my 7th grader with his homework.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, that's because you learned it the wrong way because it's forgettable. Like I remember in a biochemistry class, learning how to draw all and know the chemical makeup of, oh my God, I can't even remember the name of it. But we have to
glucose,
draw
glucose, carbon.
It was something like that.
Something.
But like, all these things. And I remember trying to memorize how do you draw this stuff. I
mm-hmm.
couldn't do it for you.
Maybe
now.
All the amino acids or
That's
something.
That's what it was.
Yes,
it was
totally.
All the amino acids.
Yeah.
And trying to remember how to draw them and all this stuff. I knew it for about
yeah,
2 days.
Memorized
you
it.
Memorized it. And that's the problem. It's like, yeah, I couldn't tell you anything about it now. But where I excelled, where I started doing well in math, is when I realized, oh, no, it's like if you get this idea down, it's a lot better. And so when I was teaching this stuff, that was the fun part where it's like, let's not learn it this way. I'll give you an example. Trigonometry, we have to learn the unit circle. I had to teach the unit circle. I don't even remember learning it because probably because I forgot it.
Yeah.
But that was the thing. I saw what some of these kids were doing in other classes, and they were memorizing this very complicated circle. And so when I taught it to my students, it's like, you're not, if you memorize it, you're doing it wrong. Here is the concepts at play here. And if you know these couple concepts, you can regurgitate this thing eventually. And you could do all the problems in your head really quickly.
Yes.
And I think if they are using that in a pre-calculus class or a calculus class down the road, they will remember it. And it's not one of those things they're just going to forget easily. Maybe if they never see it again for a while, I can understand.
Sure.
But for their next few classes, they will know how to do it because it's not a memory thing. It's not like, oh, I got to memorize this again.
No,
you're doing it wrong.
It's about manipulating it in your head and looking at triangles and looking at angles and being able to follow those lines.
And so the new math, quote unquote, that's what they're trying to do.
That's
great. Get the concepts down. And parents have a hard time understanding it because they didn't learn it that way.
Of course.
And
math is math, right?
Math
it's not supposed to change.
And this is the thing. Like, this is the thing I wrote in that popular post, which was like, if I go to Starbucks and it's like $4.65 coffee and I have a 20, how much change should I get back? No one in their right mind is going to get out a piece of paper. Let's say the computer's down. No one's going to get out of paper and do 20 minus 465, carry the 10. No, they're like 465. Well, I need 35 cents to get to $5.
And then it's
15.
Then
15, I'm done.
Yeah.
That's what the new math is that they're trying to teach these kids to do because it's faster.
And it's also usable.
And it's usable, yeah.
In some ways, my math skills are a bit slow. Like, I'm slow with mental math, but I'm still capable of doing complicated problem solving in math because, it takes me a minute to add up those things in my head. And I don't have the chart memorized.
Right.
So I have to physically look at like maybe six across and four down and how many does that fill in and whatever. But then eventually I can do things that are much more complicated because I can visually manipulate. I'm fascinated, for example, by kids in China who do like abacus competitions.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're learning concepts.
Yes.
They're good at learning. And in, I think, Finland, too, they're very good at learning these concepts early on. And this is the hard part, because the reason Common Core, I think, in part gets such a bad rap is this has to start at an early age where you teach them these methods, and then it carries over as they go through. So what happens when you take kids who learn the rote skills and memorize stuff,
and you say,
now we're switching gears
as
you're getting older? And that's a tough transition.
Well, also, Common Core gets a bad rap for the same reason that I think No Child Left Behind and a lot of these issues. They get a bad rap when there's a one-size-fits-all model for kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I do get that if there's something that is kind of proven to be more effective, that we should opt for that first.
Right.
But there might be kids who still struggle, and those kids might need additional help.
And Common Core has a problem too, which is that it still does rely on standardized testing, and that's in every state. And like,
and
that's,
then teachers are teaching to the
and
test.
And teachers are teaching to
it's
the
not,
test.
Yeah, the problem isn't the standardized test per se. It's the pressure that a standardized test puts on a curriculum building.
This is what I don't miss about teaching. It's that. I mean, and my school was very good. They didn't make me turn in lesson plans. They were very good about saying, don't teach to the test, but you do got to cover some of this material.
Because you still have to do that. Their school,
they have to take it.
Yes.
They're going to take the ACT. They're going to have to.
And their school's going to be rated based on how well they do. Like,
right.
I see this. My mother is a middle school Spanish teacher, and she is brilliant, and she developed. She teaches a lot of native speakers. She teaches in Texas, and there are a lot of Mexican children who.
My sister teaches in Arizona. Same concept.
Same thing, yeah. So really brilliant kids. And you would think, okay, young kids that have Spanish as their first language should be able to read novels in Spanish, but a lot of them can't. And you know, they're not able, they don't have these upper level. It's the same thing as looking at somebody who is, you know, English, proficient in English, but can they read Tolstoy? I don't know. So my mother developed this amazing program for middle school kids, I think 7th or 8th graders, to basically do this curriculum that she came up with, and then they take the test for Spanish 4 AP.
Yeah.
So this is like senior level high school.
English,
and
Spanish.
If they get a 4 or 5 on their AP test,
they're golden.
30 hours of college credit.
That is awesome.
And these are kids in 8th grade who oftentimes come from households that don't promote higher education, where there's an expectation, no, you're going to go to work or you're going to help support the family. And all of a sudden, they have a whole year of college under their belt they never had to pay for. It's huge. It's a great motivator for
these
kids.
You might appreciate this. We tried an experiment at our school. The school I taught at was predominantly white.
Okay.
And one of the issues is, if you look at the scores, we did this in an assembly once where they wanted to make a point to the teachers where they said, here are the scores from like last year's standardized test or something. We're breaking it down by ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, we're just going to show you the numbers for math, for example. One group of kids scored at this low level. There was another low level, a high level, and a slightly higher level. And they said, what's sad is we could probably tell you which lines are the African-American kids, the white kids, the Asian kids, what have you. It's like, that's a problem.
That's a huge problem.
Well, what are we going to do to fix it? And here's the thing. When they talked, they literally called out. Like, they asked the Hispanic kids, they asked the African-American kids, we want to talk to you because we want to figure out how to fix this. What are we doing wrong that we can help you out with this? And a lot of these kids were very bright kids. They said, you know, I'll take an honors class. I'll take an AP class, but I'm the only Hispanic kid here. And I can't talk to them about, I can't talk to other kids about the same stuff because we're going through different issues. And they said, so what would it make it better for you? And they said, it would be kind of cool if I had another person who was black, Hispanic in my class. So what they did is the following year, they said, okay, we're going to push kids into these honors classes. Maybe we wouldn't have otherwise. Maybe their grades
weren't there.
Maybe they're B-level kids. Right, yeah. Let's have them take these honor classes. And we're going to put them in the same classroom with teachers who know that we're trying to do this. So in my class, my honors class or something, I had like more minority kids than I ever had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And what was funny is, I mean, none of the kids really knew what was going on, but I did. And what was cool is you never would have guessed, like, there was that they shouldn't have been in that class.
They rose
to the occasion. They did very well. Sure, they struggled because it's a tough course, and they weren't used to these challenging courses. But they knew they could talk to somebody. They knew that, oh, I can ask for help and that's not a big deal anymore. It was a cool experiment to try. And they was like, oh, I don't feel like I'm the only black girl in this class anymore. And that was, they said
this
later.
Which can be so alienating.
Yeah. And they were like, it was so cool. And like, I wasn't the token in this class. Yes. And
also
it helped.
It shows how much there's this negative feedback loop of an expectation and a stereotype threat. Oh, you're the black kids in school. You're probably not going to do as well as the other kids.
Right, right.
So we're going to continue to put you in the regulars or the resource
classes. The feedback
loop
is never good. And now we're trying to like short circuit that. And I think it was a good challenge to do. I don't know if they still do it. Mm-hmm. But I know for a while, like, it was a good thing. And not all the kids did great, but a lot of them are like, oh, the following year, yeah, I want to take another honors class in the line.
Well, it can be so good for your self-esteem.
Yeah.
Especially, like, let's say you go in and you go in as a C-level student, and then you end up having, you know, going from a 72 to a 78.
Yeah.
And you show improvement.
And it's a harder class, too. Yes. And it's like, whoa, I can do what these other kids are doing in this class.
And that's something I wish that we could figure out a grading system in this country that graded based on improvement.
Yeah.
And graded based on skills acquisition and not just based on, like, maintenance, you know, maintaining this, like, A-level average, which, honestly, I think is bad for college prep. It's bad. What you don't want, I would never, if I was on the board of admissions, I would never want that kid who had a 4.3 GPA, who had a perfect 1600
on his... Who never tried because they were just good. They knew how to do it.
And who also never failed.
Yeah.
Who never smoked pot. Who never, like, got in trouble.
That would be a cool application. Like, I got straight A's, but wait.
Exactly,
let me tell you about the other side of me.
Because the truth is, that kid shows up to the Ivy League school and they realize they're not the best in the class anymore. Yeah. There's a million other kids just like them. They struggle. The first time they make a C on a test, they lose their fucking
minds. Oh, my
God.
They go crazy. I've told this to, because I work with a lot of seniors now and stuff, and I coach them all the time. And they're like, you know, what about, they're thinking about college. And I was like, you know, a lot of these kids are shooting for these big, great schools and stuff. And it's like, well, consider, just think about this. Let's say you get into Harvard or something. You're not going to be the smartest kid there.
No.
You're going to be in the middle of the pack for the most part, and you're going to be surrounded by people who are brilliant and stuff. And that's not a bad thing. There's so many benefits to that.
There's going
to
be the you of every other school that fed into
right.
that. Yeah.
But think about this. If you go to a state school that a lot of your friends are going to as well, you really have a chance to stand out and be the amazing one there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a benefit a lot of them don't consider. They just see, like, you know, if I go to that school, people will think I am that type of student. It's like, no, you're a brilliant student. I work with you all the time. You're going to be brilliant no matter where you go.
Yes.
But there is a huge benefit to being a big fish in a smaller pond
here. I agree.
That you may not get at these reach schools that you're trying to get into. Give it a shot.
Also, I personally, you know, I went to a state school.
I did
and
too.
I love that it was a commuter college and I was surrounded by
people.
Where'd you go? I went to the University of North Texas.
Okay. And I went to University of Illinois Chicago, which is not Champaign-Urbana, which is the big one.
Yeah.
So it's like the side school that no one, I have to explain, like, well, it's not that one.
Yeah,
it's
you just... and I have to explain too, like, UNT is not, it's not UT, it's not a UT campus.
Yeah.
It's a totally different school. And it's a big school, 30,000, 35,000 kids.
Commuter school, though.
Commuter school, 45 minutes from where I grew up.
Right.
And I loved it today. And what I learned there, because that's where I started teaching, I had the, I think, positive experience of teaching in college, not in high school, which.
Yeah.
In some ways is less fulfilling, in some ways is way better because you don't have to deal with parents.
Yeah.
Which
well,
is
people ask me
nightmare.
All the time, they're like, why don't you get your, I have my master's.
Uh-huh.
Like, why don't you teach college? I'm like, it's not as personal. I had my college professors, I don't know any of them.
Yeah.
It wasn't personal for me.
For some people, it's not, totally.
High
I
school
think
is perfect.
Because I taught in the biological sciences,
yeah.
I got to teach a lot of labs, which means there were only 24 kids in my class,
yeah.
which was great.
Nice small classes.
Nice small classes.
You're doing stuff.
Some of my students were older than
yeah.
me. It was like super weird. That's the great thing about a commuter school. And also kids of different walks of life. They weren't all carbon
yeah.
copies of one
oh
another.
Oh my God, yes.
But one thing I loved is that I got to work in a lab. And again, it's kind of, there's pluses and minuses. I have friends who went to Caltech, top tier school,
right.
incredibly competitive, can get any job they want. But they would do some leg of a Nobel laureate's research project, which got them publications and it got them, but they were always like the fifth author.
Right.
It got them clout. I got to walk into a lab that was a hot mess
yeah.
and run it.
And you learn how it works,
I
really.
Learned,
and
I had
the
to.
The ins and outs.
I had to. I managed my cell culture facility because
yeah.
because nobody else would.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that to me, because I had no interest in being this like scientist whose name ended up in the textbooks.
Right.
I had an interest in like.
You want to learn
owning
science.
My life,
yeah,
right? Like, I wanted to be, like, the master of my life. And in order to do that, you had to master skills.
Yeah.
And I was really able to do that, which
this is
I don't think I could have done if I hadn't gone to state school.
This is something I admire about you. And this is one of the things I'm trying to figure out right now, which is all the stuff that I am doing right now, I really don't know people who do it,
mm-hmm.
right? And, like, when I was teaching, there's a whole bunch of colleagues I can ask about anything, and that's great. All the stuff I'm trying to do now is almost a blank thing where I'm like, I got to figure this one out on my own. I got to forge my own path here because there's not a lot of people I could talk to about
this. And it can be
stuff.
Tough. Eventually you do. I think you do find a community. I've managed
yeah.
to find a great community. But I will tell you, I mentioned this in my talk yesterday.
Yeah.
I basically, when I first started doing science communication, when I first left my graduate degree and I said, okay, I'm going to do SciComm for a living, I was like, I'm so smart. I came up with a new job.
Right.
No
right.
one else does this. I'm the first person. I literally had no understanding that there was an entire community
there are
of people.
People who do this,
yes,
right.
who like
yeah.
do it for a living.
Yeah.
And there are ways to get together with them and have conversations with them. And since then, I've made amazing friends. I have
right.
a group of friends. We call ourselves the Nerd Brigade. We're all science communicators. No lie, we went to visit Meteor Crater about a month
yeah.
ago because my friend Meg is a planetary scientist who just finished at Caltech. She actually did a double PhD because she's insane.
Of course she did. Yeah, right.
She did a PhD in planetary science and did all of the coursework and research and thesis project for
God.
A PhD in the history of science, but they wouldn't grant her two because they're like, why do you, what are you doing? And she's like, oh, okay. So,
yeah.
but she wanted to take us to Meteor Crater in Arizona to show us this amazing impact crater.
Yeah.
And she arranged this great tour. We got to walk around the rim of the crater. It was amazing.
Yeah.
We took an RV. It was very scary. But when we got there, it was so funny. After this long RV ride, we pull up and the woman at the counter is like, Joe, there's a group of people here who call themselves the Nerd Brigade. We were all like, yes. It sticks.
You can make up your own title and
it's
other people have
totally.
To use it.
And this is a great thing that I'm finding is that you like you do find like-minded people, but
yeah.
I will give you that there is a bit of isolation
yeah.
in doing what we choose to do because it's more than what we're doing for a living. It's the how of it. It's the fact that we're freelancers.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I talk about this on the podcast a lot, and I think a lot of people listening can really relate because especially having a strong millennial audience,
yeah.
a lot of millennials
are
freelance. They're making their own way.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're working for themselves.
I can find a community of people who do similar things to what I'm doing, but I have to search for the and like
yes.
Skepticon, the conference we're at. I have to go here to find these people. When I'm at home, there is nobody.
It's tough.
And
that's how I did it. I had to go to science online, right, which was the first time that I really met a lot of these great people.
And it's different when it's the communities online, but like all of my MeetSpace friends, like none of them, you asked me before we started this interview, like what title do you give me? And it's like, my friends will ask me that too. Like, so what do you do? And I'm like, well, I do things on the internet. And they're like, I don't get how that's a job.
I'm they're like, how do you pay your bills?
Right. I'm like, I swear it makes sense, but it's weird and it's hard to explain to people who have traditional things.
Yes.
And I mean, to their credit, my parents and even my wife, they were like, I mean, we don't really get how this works, but it's working. I mean, you can not be homeless and do this.
Yeah.
So we'll get out of your way. But you know, hang on to that teaching certificate just
seriously,
in case.
Yeah, yeah. Can't hurt to have a backup plan.
Right.
I always maintain my backup plan, too. There was a couple of years at the beginning when I switched from academia straight into psychom.
Yeah.
Where I didn't, you know, I got a TV gig here and I got a TV gig there and they paid really well. And then all of a sudden it just kind of stopped coming.
Right.
And I would
there's a lot of projects I do now where I'm like, I can do this and maybe it'll go somewhere.
Exactly.
But usually it doesn't.
And it's like, well, I'm not going to get paid until I won't get paid.
Right.
This is on spec. Should
right.
I be doing this? Or,
right.
Oh, I got a sat hit on CNN that millions of people saw, but I didn't get a paycheck for it.
Right.
So,
and I don't know if that's going to lead to anything.
Exactly.
And that's happened a few times too. And it's so funny when they're like, oh, you did an interview. You did an interview with this journalist for an article. How much did you get paid for that? I'm like, I didn't get paid.
Yeah, you don't get paid for that.
That.
I'm not paying you for sitting down
right.
and podcasting with
right.
me. That's not the way it works.
And it's weird because this is the stuff people tend to hear a lot. And they're like, but if that's what you do,
and they're like,
I
but
don't
you're famous.
Understand.
You must make so much money.
Yeah, where is that coming from?
Exactly. I had that recently. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I recently got an electric car. I'm leasing a Chevy Spark, which I love to death. It's so amazing. It's super cute. It's like $199 a month. totally affordable. But when I was first researching electric cars, I tweeted something like, okay, electric cars, what recommendations do you have? I'm so excited. I want to, you know, compare them all. Tesla.
Yeah.
Tesla.
Yeah.
You should get a Tesla. Get a Tesla. Get
Do
a
you
Tesla.
Know how much a Tesla
I know.
Is?
And so I tweet something like, I don't feel like I should have to explain this, but I cannot afford a Tesla. And no lie, I got responses from people that were like, but you're on TV. How can you not afford a Tesla? And
right.
I'm like, wow.
You're on YouTube. Don't
exactly.
you just get money? I'm like, no, they did a South Park episode where the kids went looking for the YouTube stars who wanted their internet money. Like,
that's so
like it
funny.
Doesn't just kind of work like that.
It doesn't. And we're very, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm fortunate and I'm lucky. And thank you guys for supporting and you helped me make it. And
right.
I'm finally doing well enough to feel like, oh, this is like a legit career.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm not struggling as much as my, like, for example, as some of my family members who are like teachers and make
right.
no money. And so I'm doing better, but it's so much work.
It is a lot of work.
And it's one job comes that pays really, really well. And you're like, yes.
And I'm good for a little bit, maybe.
Yes,
and
that job carries you. Like, I'll do one job in a week that might pay for most people half of their salary.
Right.
But then the rest of the year, I'm literally looking for more work.
Well, and this is what authors a lot of times have to deal with, too. They're like, well, you're an author and, like, you get an advance. But, like, usually those even nice book advances and stuff, it's not even a year salary, not even for most traditional jobs and stuff.
And it's definitely not what it used to
be. It's a one-time thing, too.
And most people don't fulfill their advances anymore.
Right,
so
you're not going to get any more.
Yeah, the idea is to argue or is to negotiate for an advance that's so high that you'll never get royalties on the back end.
Right.
Because that's how an advance works, of course. They'll say, okay, I'll give you $50,000 to write this book.
And if you hit that mark, we'll start paying you royalties.
Exactly. Then you'll make $3 a book or $2 a book after that. But you're like, up it. Sure, $75,000, I'll take it, knowing that you might not ever even sell that much.
And this is the thing where it's, there are people who support it and who like it. And they make it possible. But it is hard trying to explain to people who don't come from that world where it's like, well, I can make it work and I'm fortunate because not a lot of people can make it work.
But that doesn't mean it's not a lot of work to make it work.
Yeah, they think like, oh, you work on the internet, therefore you set your hours, which one, that means you don't have to work. Like, just because I don't have to get up at 5 a.m. every single day, they think I don't work.
Or that, I hear all the time
like,
that I'm lazy.
I'm always working.
Exactly. Like, I'm lazy because I don't wake up, like, at the butt crack of dawn.
Right.
And it's like, fuck you. Even if I did. Like, when I had an office job, those hours in the day were just useless. Like, I got nothing accomplished.
I'm a zombie
Exactly. Yeah. Until, like, noon or two when I start to be productive.
Right.
But then I work until midnight.
Well, this was the thing. I got a lot of friends that are like, well, do you miss teaching? I do miss teaching. But you know what? I taught for about 2 hours a day, maybe, if I was lucky. And that's if I was teaching in every class and not giving a test or something. So maybe 2 hours. The other 6 hours were doing all the other shit you got to do as a teacher.
Grading papers.
Grading paper, talking to parents, calling up parents, dealing with...
Coming in to be the person who stands there at lunch.
Yeah, no.
Or stands in the hall.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big part of your job.
For math teachers, they didn't make us stand in the hall, but we did have to do free tutoring during that period. Which was a useful use of our time, which is nice. But
of course.
No, you're doing that for 6 hours. And that's where it was like, you know what? I know that when I do my own thing and I set my own schedule, I know that I'm working the whole time, and it's stuff I should be doing or need to be doing,
and it's stuff that you love. Not that teaching isn't, of course, I miss teaching too. But yeah, it comes with a lot of headaches.
Yeah.
Again, because I was fortunate to teach at the university level, I had less of those headaches.
Right.
But then I had the added bonus of doing it while I was doing research and doing it while I was taking coursework and kill me in my face. Like, it just was not. And all I wanted to do was be in the classroom. I was like, I want to go to the lab.
When I was in college, I taught for Kaplan, the test prep company.
Uh-huh,
and
yeah.
I taught SAT and ACT classes. And that was nice for a part-time job. And then when I was in med school, I actually taught MCAT classes for them. And that was so much fun because all of these people taking this, older people too, they all want to be there, which is a very different from my parents are paying for it.
Totally. When you're older, even early, freshman level college is a little different. But as you get to upper level college, it's like, you don't have to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, you're paying for this because you want this.
Kids fuck off in class, and I'm like, okay, leave. And they're like, you can do that? I'm like, yeah.
You're paying me. I don't care.
Exactly.
And then when I had dropped out of med school and I was trying to do teaching, I kind of want to get away from med school altogether.
Mm.
And all the people I'm teaching, they're so anal retentive about stuff in the MCAT classes. I'm like, what else could I try? So I tried the LSAT. They let me teach LSAT because they were very good about it. And
amazing.
I took a practice one. Those students who wanted to go to law school. First of all, it's a much funner test because logic games and puzzles.
Oh, cool.
And I'm like, I like this class to teach. And we are getting down to work all the time. There's no bullshit you got to deal with. And they all want to be there. I had so much fun doing that. I applied for a full-time job there. They just didn't have an opening pretty much. But I'm like, I'm doing the right thing. I do want to teach because this is a blast. And it's very different from that for-profit world versus the public school world. But, man, that was the best job I had, that part-time, teaching classes. It was so much fun because they wanted to be there. They were fun to talk to. I was a little younger than a lot of them, but I don't think that came across. I hope that didn't come across. But, we could actually talk about this stuff, and it was a blast.
Well, so long as you were helping them learn, I think they
could
give a shit.
Yeah, they were like, long as this makes sense when you teach it,
so long as
good.
I get a good grade on the LSAT, that's all that matters to me.
Exactly.
That's so great. That's great. And I think it's just really important. I mean, for anybody listening, for us talking, that you find some amount of joy in the work that you do.
Yeah.
And more than anything, it doesn't even have to be that day-to-day joy, because I know that it's like we say, they call it work for a reason.
Right.
Like, it can be a total grind and it can really wear on you.
And especially when you're in the public eye, where anything you do, I screwed up a project not long ago and it's like, oh, this is in the Washington Post now.
Yeah, which is a bit scary.
Oh, that happens.
or even if it's the kind of grind where you're working fucking construction every day and your back is breaking and your feet are hurting, but at the end of your life, they've done many psychological studies about this, and they ask, what is the thing that is most fulfilling to you? What do you look back on? What mattered the most to you? And everybody says the same two things: love and work.
Yeah,
that so long as you get
you're doing something you were passionate about,
a sense of accomplishment, a sense of feeling good about the work that you put in solid hours and you made the world better in some way.
Yeah.
You did your part, your duty, and then you brought home the spoils, to help support your family.
Yeah.
I think that's what's so important. And I fear that we're living in a culture that doesn't recognize that anymore, and that a lot of people are not in a position where they can do that. They're in a position where they're busting their ass just to get by, and that we don't have appropriate regulation, and we don't have, I don't think, the sense of kind of we're only as strong as the weakest among us. We just don't have that culturally.
I don't know if you see this too. A lot of my friends, if they're talking about their jobs on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, there's a lot of complaining about it.
Of course.
And what's weird is the stuff I do. Yeah, no, it is work a lot. But There's not much to complain about.
I complain about all the flights.
Yeah, which is a very different problem than I hate where I'm going on that flight.
Like,
you know,
exactly. I complain about the flights. It's a luxury problem
right.
for me to
First
be like,
world,
I'm
yeah,
so
luxury.
Tired yeah. from having the 9th flight this month. Like, yeah, it's kicking my ass, right. but Jesus, that means I'm
that's
working.
That's a cool problem to have, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, oh, my internet was slower. Like, oh,
I know.
Yeah,
it's like, come
like,
on.
Too bad.
Shut up. No, totally. No, and so at the same time, yes, we have to maintain perspective
right.
a little bit.
Right.
And so one thing we didn't get to, even though yeah. we're really running low on time, we haven't talked yet about your second book.
Yeah.
Which is so cool.
Yeah, this was a personal project, more or less, which, you know, because I worked with the Secular Student Alliance and I had worked with young atheists for a long time. And you know what? What was interesting is when I was writing about atheism on my website, all the stories about young atheists taking a stance in their school, like this teacher is preaching in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
That is wrong. And I'm going to be the one to stop it. Those stories always got such amazing responses and stuff. And so I wrote this book called A Young Atheist Survival Guide. I actually wanted it to be called Unsaved by the Bell. They did not like that.
That's but, so cute.
And I'm sure there would have been legal problems or something.
Yeah.
But the story was, let's talk about how all of us, whether you're religious or not even, how do we help these young atheists who are trying, who in some cases cannot come out of the closet as an atheist, who have stood up for their rights and what happened to them as a result, and being able to follow up on what a lot of these stories from a few years ago were
yeah.
doing. And
these
realize
kind of Supreme Court cases
yeah.
that we've heard
like,
about.
How are those kids still
yeah,
doing?
Like this
and you
14-year-old that like brought a case, you know, to the Supreme Court. Yeah. Like how badass is that?
Oh yeah.
What and are they like, dealing with that? Because they got so much media attention too.
Yeah. And as someone who got that at a younger age, and it's like, I mean, I think I lucked out because like it didn't. I don't think it traumatized me or like it didn't do anything bad to me.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these kids were like the comments under their stories were just nasty to begin with, and
oh,
you're
completely.
Like, how are you doing now?
So they're doing it in the age of social media
yeah.
and they're doing it sometimes well, within families that are not supportive.
And one of the like the way I start the book was there was a girl about 10 years ago who didn't say the pledge of the Lord's Prayer and the pledge after
they had
a basketball
to say the
Lord's Prayer
oh
after a basketball game at a public school. She said it wasn't a legal issue for her. It was like, oh, I don't think I want to do this basically.
Yeah.
And she was kicked out of the team and all. It was crazy. And the things people did to her in class, they didn't physically beat her, but all the things they called her names and all the stuff that went on. What a horrible thing for any 14-year-old girl to have to deal with. And what was weird
yeah.
is 10 years later, a very similar story happened where a girl said, this mural in my school's auditorium is a prayer. I don't think that should be there. And she was the plaintiff in a lawsuit. She won the lawsuit. And when she won, yes, some of that same stuff happened. But now you got death threats and rape threats on
yes.
Twitter. Now you have all these Facebook. But what was really cool, and this is the part I really wanted to highlight, it's the same shit they had to deal with, and now it's social media and stuff. What was really cool, though, is because of this community we have built and the way we are more supportive as an atheist skeptic community, when the latter girl, the more recent girl, had all these things to deal with online, there were people who were like, I'm following your Twitter feed in a good way. And when someone says a threat to you, I got a screenshot. I'm sending it to the police. I'm sending it to your principal so that people take action.
Yeah.
And if you need someone to walk with you to school, I've gotten those emails where they're like, you wrote a story about this kid in Oklahoma who like basically got rid of 10 Commandments posters in every classroom.
Wow.
If that kid needs a bodyguard as
yeah.
he's walking to school, I will gladly do it.
That's amazing.
That
and
didn't
also,
happen 10 years
no,
ago. So
and
that's
also,
what the book is about.
Those kids now can find other kids
yeah.
online
the number
who feel the same
of,
way.
The number of high school Secular Student Alliance type of groups has skyrocketed in the past few years. There were literally, maybe 7 years ago, there
mm-hmm.
were literally, you could count on one hand how many there were, at
wow.
least, or the ones that were recognized.
Yeah.
As a group. And that number's shot up to like maybe several dozen, and well, maybe beyond that, it's probably closer to 100 or something now. But it's shot up. It's kind of like the Gay Straight Alliance. Like, it didn't exist at all a while
exactly.
back. And all of a sudden, it's like, you can't go to a school and not find one anymore because you realize there are a lot of people who feel very passionately about this. And they know, oh, I can start a group for this. That's
yeah.
really neat.
I mean, when I came out as an atheist in high school, I literally thought I
yeah.
was the only one.
I did, too.
And I bet you there were others.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, if I had done something so brave as to make take a First Amendment stance,
yeah,
and I had gotten hate from my peers, unfortunately, I wouldn't be surprised if other non-believers would have joined in on the hate,
yeah,
just because...
Just to not be you, not
exactly
to be the targets.
And there's such this social pressure in, yeah, high school to be cliquey. And so it's so unfortunate.
You're
for these
asking
kids.
Kids to not conform, and that is the hardest thing,
no,
to do
it's
in
what
high
they
school.
You almost can't blame them,
yeah,
for doing it. You know, it's like maybe you can blame the epicenter, the, yeah, first kid who incites the violence or whatever.
Right.
But when all these other people
but
rally
there's a cultural
along,
thing, yeah,
it's all they know to do. It's all, yeah, they're taught to do. It's all society says they should do. And definitely when you're that young, too, you literally don't have the physical hardware. Like, your brain isn't
right,
developed enough. You don't have that executor telling you, like, no, you're your own person.
I
think
did
for
not,
yourself.
I did not realize that these issues, I didn't look for these issues.
Yeah.
Had it happened, I mean, this is, there were some religious things that happened at my public school that just, it didn't faze me at all.
Totally.
And now the fact that I didn't even think to start an atheist group. Oh my God, how amazing and helpful that could have been for me in high school. I didn't even know that was a possibility.
Yeah.
And the hope is like, well, now, whether you're on Reddit, whether you're anywhere else, it's like, oh, this is a thing people do. I can do it too.
And you can do it safely.
I, yeah,
think not only did I not think to do it when I was in high school, even if the thought had crossed my mind, I probably would have been like, I'm not going to be that,
right,
that target.
Right.
Like, that's not, I just wasn't like that. I wasn't outspoken. I was really shy. I mean, even,
yeah,
even now it's funny because I'm very outspoken behind the microphone,
right,
and behind the lens of the camera. But when I get up, and yes, I'm comfortable getting up and talking to a big group of people, but I'm very shy. Like, you saw at Dino Prom, like, they had a weird prom at the Skepticon thing, which was fun, but like,
yeah,
it's not my scene.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just kind of hide in the corner.
Well, it's funny. When I'm around my friend, most of my friends at home have nothing to do with atheism, right?
Oh,
so like,
see, all of my friends,
okay,
are atheists.
So almost none of my friends back home, because I know my closest friends from school, and so they're all the doctor types. They're all doing that stuff. That's how I know
them.
Wouldn't
they then kind of all be atheists too?
Yeah, maybe, but like, it's when we get together, we never talk about this stuff.
Huh.
And so I'm very reluctant to be the one to bring it up ever.
Interesting.
Thankfully, I never really have a need to do it. But
when
than
they're like, hey, where were you this weekend?
Then it comes up or something. But like, and they kind of know what I do and stuff. But like, we don't talk about religion. We don't talk about any of that stuff. We're talking about our lives. We're talking about other stuff. It's only when I come to these conferences.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
So it's a very separate life. But like, yeah, like when I'm at home or something, it seems like I have a dual life, because my closest friends and certainly my family members and stuff, it's just not something we talk about.
Interesting.
And it's something very clearly limited to my online life,
huh,
and everyone else. The people close to me, it's not about atheism.
I'm
weird.
Trying to bring it more into my online,
yeah,
life. I think it's so central to my identity now, and it could be partially because we probably came out around the same time.
Yeah.
I was about 14.
Ditto.
But I was raised in a very religiously oppressive household, whereas you were
I was not
oppressive. Much more secular.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, it was such an identity shift,
yeah,
when I finally said, like, I don't believe, and it's okay for me to say it out loud, and
yeah,
I'm gonna push back against my father, and I'm, you know,
right,
and it took so much.
It's the
strength.
First. It is the first decision I ever made, big decision, by myself. No,
huh,
one else taught me about it.
Yeah.
I figured it out for myself. It wasn't
me too.
A friend.
Yeah, I didn't know anybody
that's
who was an
atheist.
The
first time in my life that I ever made such a big decision, and I knew I was right. And
no,
you know, of course everyone does, but like, no one convinced me of that. I'm like, I can figure this shit out on my own.
Yeah.
Like,
and for me, it was so defining.
It's a big deal.
That it really became, in many ways, a core aspect of my personality.
Yeah.
And so I would venture to guess that, you know, the vast majority of my friends at home, and not even guess, like, I pretty much know almost all of them are also atheists, or
yeah,
at least, you know, agnostic, secular, whatever.
Yeah.
But only a very small percentage of that group are activists, are people,
yeah,
who speak publicly about,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I do have some close friends who are like, oh, I mean, I'm not really religious. It's more,
yeah,
of an apathetic.
But they're
apathetic.
Not like writing blogs about,
well,
it.
Well, no, and they don't talk about it. They're more apathetic about religion. It's just like, oh, it's just not a thing. My wife,
yeah,
is the same way too. It's like, she would define herself, I guess, as an atheist.
If she had to.
If she,
yeah,
had to, but it's like, I just don't talk about religion. It's just not,
yeah,
a thing for me.
And that's totally fair too, especially,
yeah,
like, I think it would be different for me if I was still in a university setting, or if I was,
mm-hmm,
a public high school teacher, you know, that's not going to be something I spout around with other, with my peers. Whereas I have this kind of freedom to have this freelance life where we sit around and think, you know, and like have philosophical conversations.
And hopefully shape people's opinions and do all that.
You know, that's like a big part of my job.
I never brought it up in the office, in the teacher's lounge or anything, but my colleagues, again,
they knew. Read the article.
But they were good about it. They would joke about it. None of them wanted to argue religion with me. But they would be like, we need a snow day. Hemant, you pray because it'll mean more coming from you.
I have a lot of that. My friends always say to me that, you know, if somebody says something about the soul, they will...
They'll look at you funny
Like, well, Kara doesn't have a soul. So I'm like, you're right. You're so right.
Oh, it's funny. Yeah, when religion comes up, they'll all like just look in my direction. I was coaching one of these public speaking kids, and she's doing a script where she has to be funny. And one of the jokes in the script is it's like a Family Guy cutaway to God. And the way she was doing it was just she had her hands folded together like she was doing a prayer. And she says the one funny line is God, like, yes, okay, I'll do this. And it made sense in context. But we were looking at it, they were like, all the kids just kind of looked at me because they all know I don't talk, but they all know. And they're like, is that okay? I'm like, well, it's fine. It's not as funny as it could be. And we changed it so she wasn't doing the Christian stereotypical God, but she was doing like another religion's God. And we're like, you can get a bigger laugh
out
of it.
Krishna or something.
Yeah. And we're like, you'll get a bigger laugh if you do that. Because it's like, it's a purely practical thing.
You have to know your audience.
Yeah. And the kid, but it's funny because anytime religion comes up, the kids who know me well and they will Google stalk me or whatever, they'll give me a look like, should we say this?
You're the token atheist.
I know. And I'm the one who's like, I'm not talking about this with any of you guys.
That's so
we're here
you're
professionally.
Like, we are not crossing this line.
Right.
I don't want your parents calling me up tonight.
Right.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, hey, you know what? We've gone a while, and I'm so happy to have you. It's getting really late, so I feel guilty. It's like after midnight here.
Yeah.
So I got to ask you. Yes. I always end every episode of Talk Nerdy with the same two questions. The first being, when in whatever context makes sense to you, personal, whatever. When you look to the future, what is the thing that most concerns you? What keeps you up at night? What are you most worried about? And then on the flip side of that, same thing. When you look to the future, what are you excited about and hopeful for?
Is this personally or in general?
Personally, globally, whatever you want. Whatever is that salient thing, or both. I don't care.
You know, the scary thing is, a lot of the stories I read about when it comes to religion and stuff, it feels like it's the same story all the time. Like, this shit hasn't gotten better. Mm-hmm. And you would think when you have more people outspoken about it, when you have the demographic shift so that there are more people saying, you know, even if you're not an atheist, like, I'm not religious and stuff.
I'm a nun.
You would think it's getting better, and yet you still see politicians doing the same stuff as always. That concerns me. It's like, it should be getting better, and it doesn't seem to be getting better in so many ways. Like, yay, gay marriage and all that stuff, but like, in a lot of other areas, religion still has a lot of power.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know how to fix that right now, and granted, I'm not going to be able to by myself.
Yeah,
but it's
why
like,
can't you fix this completely by yourself?
Politics. Yeah, but it's, I don't see it getting better, even though it seems like it should be on paper, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the optimistic side is, like, just as an atheist, that side of me, you know, it used to be when you go to conferences like this, you would see a lot of people college age and a little beyond that and super old.
Yeah.
And mostly white and mostly male. And that is not the case anymore, certainly at this conference. But in general, like, a lot of people who are middle aged, their parents with kids, like, that was a reason for them to go back to church.
Yes.
They are finding alternatives to that, which is neat. Like, they're like, I can raise my kids in a ethical humanist sort of, like,
I'm so surprised by how many times when I come to one of these conventions and
they have childcare at these things.
They have childcare. There are, like, parents who are, like, late in life, kind of deconverted.
Yeah.
And also, like, especially, this is going to come across so kind of not PC, so I apologize in advance. What I love, first of all, that there's a really good, especially at Skepticon, of, like, men and women.
Yeah.
And people who are gay, straight, trans, whatever. Mm-hmm. I love that there are people of every age. I think the one place that we're still struggling is with ethnicity.
Yeah.
We don't have enough Hispanic.
Yeah.
We don't have enough black kids. We don't have enough, you know, Asian Asian or Indian kids. Right, right. And so I'd love to see more of that. But I'm always so thrilled to see people. This, again, it's going to sound so un-PC.
Yeah.
And I'm only going to say that I can say this out loud because I grew up in Texas and maybe that
I'll
qualifies
hold it against
me.
You forever.
But like, how many people are kind of a bit rednecky?
Like we're going past the stereotype.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it. It's like you have these people who on paper you see them on a news and you go, of course that guy's Christian. He's probably a tea partier.
Right.
He's wearing camo.
That guy
and
with the southern accent is an atheist.
And
it's
got
weird.
Like the teeth and he's wearing the camo with like the fly fishing things on it. But they're like atheists.
Yeah.
And how freaking awesome is that?
And even beyond the expanding diversity, because you're right, it's more diverse than it ever was before.
But we've got ways to go.
But it's getting there. I think. I feel optimistic about that. But at the same time, so yes, we got that middle-aged kind of demographic more so. And yes, the other ways it's diverse. We also have more younger people willing to call themselves atheists, which is amazing. I've said this before, but it's like, you know, I've been writing this website for like 8 years, this blog, Friendly Atheist. And I only started the YouTube thing relatively recently.
Mm-hmm.
But the weird thing is every young person I seem to meet, if I speak at a college, even my kids that I work with now, none of them read my site. They all watch YouTube.
Yes.
And what's weird is through that channel, through YouTube in general, it's like there are a lot of young people. I see their videos. Like, maybe I don't talk about them much, but like I see their videos and they're just like, they have their webcam on. They're just like, I'm an atheist. Let me talk about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like local. It doesn't matter the quality or whatever. It's just like, that's so cool that you're just like, this is not a big deal for me. This is one of the stories I had in the Young Atheist Survival Guide. I talked to a teacher who was the faculty sponsor for a high school atheist group.
Okay.
And they were in the New York Times featured. The whole story was, they exist.
Yeah.
Like, that was the story.
Like, wow.
Wow.
Shocking.
And the faculty sponsor, I'm like, how did you even get this thing going? That's amazing. And the cool thing he told me is, you know, he finally said, I'm not going to hide the fact that I'm an atheist for my kids if they ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked him, and he said, I'm an atheist. I don't go to church. And he braced himself, like, what's the reaction going to be? And the reaction from the kids is like, oh, meh.
Yeah.
Totally don't care.
They don't give a shit.
They don't care at all. And it's like, that is so cool, because that's the worry that I had too.
Yeah.
And this is this was in Florida, but it's a conservative area as well.
Florida's very conservative.
Yeah, but no matter, a lot of places that you would think this is a scary thing to be, it's like, they're not alone. And even if they think they're the only one at school, they are finding communities online, whether anonymously or not, where they can talk about this stuff.
Totally.
I didn't have that. I'm so jealous. That
I know.
This stuff
and
wasn't
also,
around.
Even if they're not finding, here's the thing too about young people now, that when you go out there at Skepticon or at Apostacon or at American Atheist, and you go, you know, where are the teenagers? Where are the early 20 somethings? Because they're not there quite in the droves that you expect. I think part of the reason they're not there is because they don't have to be. They have a community.
Yeah.
This is definitely something that's necessary, because as you get older, you stop having friends. We all know this, right?
Right.
The older you get,
I'm
the
down
more
to like
you just like
two.
Exactly.
Right. Uh-huh.
It's like people get married and they have kids and then they're lame and they're boring and you only hang out with people you work with.
Right.
And like, what happened to my life?
And it's nice to have human contact, especially when you do what we do, which is so much stuff online, which is so much travel.
Yes.
And you meet strangers who are great, but you meet them temporarily.
Yes.
It's nice to have these people you can see in person.
Over and over.
And you see them repeatedly.
But when you're 19, you're like young and hot and you're getting laid and like you make friends within a minute. And whether you're an atheist or not, your friends might also be atheists. You might have the community or they might go, meh.
Yeah.
And you don't even care.
It's either not an issue for them, which is awesome. That's kind of the goal, right? To be activist-y.
Like, it's like being post-racial or something.
For this issue to be obsolete for them.
Totally.
Or it's just like, oh, I get my fix of talking about this stuff because I watch these people on YouTube or I listen to this podcast
and
or
I'm,
whatever.
I hang out in Reddit's atheism channel.
So
and
I got my fix and I'm good. I don't need a club for this. It's like, I'm sad, but that's kind of awesome.
No, it's kind of awesome. And you know what? We'll see them in like 15 years.
Yeah, right.
Like they'll be coming around once they're like, oh, all my friends got married and they suck.
Yeah. But that's a hard adjustment to make where it's like, I thought the blog, I was going to do that for, oh, no one's reading it. I see.
I guess
I'll move to this new
thing. You have to transition a bit.
But that's the fun part because I, and maybe you've experienced this too, like I have, I can do that now because that is what that's my job. It's following where this is going and then being there.
And being multifaceted too. You can keep blogging and you can keep, you know, I do the stuff on air when I want, but I also, as I mentioned before, I love podcasting.
Right.
I can do it in my pajamas.
Right.
I don't have to put on makeup, but I'm kind of keeping up weirdly with the times, even though this is super old technology.
Right, right.
There was like a huge podcast boom and then it kind of died out and now,
and now it's
back.
Coming back.
And better than ever.
Do you want to have another hour where we talk about the Serial podcast? Because I would totally... But yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's like, oh, now all of a
I'm addicted.
Right. It's like there are all these things. I'm like, oh, I literally had this conversation a week ago where it's my wife and I went to a concert and we finally got there. We were listening to that podcast series. And she's like, you go. I'm going to stay in the car and listen.
So
like, no, we're going. And then
like,
we were like,
go to the damn concert.
Yeah, we're like, the next day, where are we going to drive to so that we can keep listening to this?
And
but
that's
also so cool that this is a thing now. And people are, this is a boom. This is
you get to engage. It's so thrilling. And you know what? I got to say, another measure of feeling old.
Yeah.
I just recently went to see Coheed and Cambria, which is one of my favorite bands. And it was freaking amazing. And I was so happy. It was a never ender. They played all of In Keeping Secrets with Silent Earth 3, which you probably don't know what I'm talking about.
I totally don't.
Someone out there does.
Right.
It was so killer.
Yeah.
But I do remember feeling like, A, I'm the oldest person here.
Oh my God. Yeah.
B, it's really loud and I need to put in earplugs.
Holy shit. So we went to the New Pornographers last week.
Okay.
And that's exactly, I'm like, I went to see them 3 years ago, I think, when they were in Chicago, and it was the best concert ever.
And now you're like, I need
earplugs. Now I'm like, this is, I'm not even in the front row like I was last. I'm like, this is loud. And
it's
also
loud.
Who are these young people next to me?
And like, also I can't do anything like standing room only. Fuck that.
Yeah.
I'm like, did you get seats? Because I need to sit during the concert.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to keep my jacket on and like, hover silently in place.
It's so uncomfortable. I'm like, I would love
let's
a chair,
never do this
a comfortable chair to sit in. Good. I'm glad we're on the same page.
We are totally on the same page.
I am like, I am 31 going on 90.
It's the one time I've got, it's like, hey, we got out in public.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Good for us. We're never doing this again.
Exactly. I won't see live music again for a long time. Anyway, well, Hemant, that was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining
me.
Before we finish up, let everybody know where they can read your blog, see your stuff, tweet you.
Friendlyatheist.com is the website. If you go on YouTube and search for The Atheist Voice, that is the YouTube channel. And we do have a podcast. It's called The Friendly Atheist Podcast because, one, we are not creative with coming up with a name, and two, the acronym made me laugh. So that's it. So you can find me there. Or you could do what all my students do and just Google my name and you'll find something.
And you're on Twitter too, right?
Oh, yeah. Twitter at Hemant Mehta, one word.
That's very easy.
Good luck spelling that. Hopefully you'll have a link. Yes.
I will provide a link. All right. Well, thank you again for joining. And everybody at home listening, thank you so much for listening, for supporting the podcast. I'm really looking forward.
Support this podcast.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.